Okay, so tonight I have the absolute pleasure of you're not supposed to clap for yourself. I have the absolute pleasure of introducing a man who changed our family. And speakers speak, leaders lead, and I know all that stuff. But I just, without any further ado, Tom, please come on up and give your pitch. And I have a nice little, I know we don't let Irish people in Alcoholics Anonymous, but here's a little cap on behalf of Alcoholics Anonymous.
I've got to turn on my nitrous oxide. You don't expect me to do this sober, do you? That's better. Anyway, hi everybody. My name is Tom Whalen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
And thank you, Derek, for the inconvenience of coming up here 5 hours in the car yesterday. 5 hours home again tomorrow, but I'm not going to bring it up. Anyway, it's been nice seeing you and the family and everybody, and I enjoyed, as I always do, listen to my beautiful wife tell her story. Always makes me cry and laugh and everything else. It's just a beautiful story. I'm going to do what all of us are asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, just to tell a little bit about what I used to be like, what happened to me, what I'm like now. And if you can get some good out of it, fine. I know that I will be the one that gets the most out of it, because that's the way it works. Because I've had a difficult time in the last, about the last 7.5 years, maybe or more. I had four-way bypass surgery 7 years ago, and then a couple of years later I had some stents put in, and then after that I thought I was fine. And then I had these terrible headaches, which is 4 years ago next month. And I went to the hospital to get some relief. They could find nothing wrong with me, and they finally gave me a test, one of those CT scans, and found that I had a brain bleed, subdural hematoma, they call it. And I had the first of two brain surgeries. I had to learn how to walk again, talk again, and work with all that kind of stuff, and it was not fun to go through. I'll tell you that, and I really felt awful. My wife has been just a saint as far as taking care of me and doing all the stuff that she has to do for me. And last June, I thought I was getting better, and then I thought I had the flu, and then I found out that I had pneumonia. I had to go back in the hospital for another couple of weeks, and it was just you feel like going outside someday and saying, hey, pick on somebody else for a while, you know. But anyway, once in a while I get a chance to share my story of what I used to be like, what happened, what I'm like now. And when I'm able to do that, it brings me back to the reality, the perception that things are bad. There's nothing like it was in 1965, my last year of drinking. It was horrible, hideous. And I'm going to get to that in a few minutes, but it's way ahead of whatever it was in 65, I'll tell you that. Anyway, I didn't start drinking until I was in grammar school. I didn't want to get in too soon, but I love drinking. I love being loaded. Remember once I was in the Army, our Army, I went in 1953, and it was about 1954. I woke up one morning and I'd written a note to myself, and the note said, I am stoned out of my mind, having a wonderful time, so there. Now, who I was talking to, I don't really know, but I scored some liquid phenobarbital the night before, which is, I highly recommend that. That's really good stuff. And I drank at every opportunity, and most of them were inappropriate, but I love drinking. I loved everything about it, and I would have continued to drink. It would still be, I'd be drinking tonight. I wouldn't be alive, but I would still be drinking tonight if I was able to do it, because I just can't even imagine When I finally did get sober, I couldn't imagine, before I got sober, I could not imagine going a day without a drink. I just couldn't, it wasn't even in the reality of my life. I just, what's the point of that? It was horrible. But anyway, I married a girl I shouldn't even dated. And now that marriage came a couple of sons. And I got out of the Army in 1956, and I went back to work for my dad in the electrical contracting business. And I've been drinking now on a daily basis since I was a junior in high school. And I'm now, in my early 20s, and I'm a husband and a father, and barely 22 years old. I felt like my life is over. It's screwed, for Christ's sake. It's awful. So I drank all the time. Then I figured working for my dad in the electrical contracting, but somehow my drinking during the day didn't fit into the stereotypical idea of how I should be, and so I decided not to drink during the day, which I didn't do. I just didn't drink during the day. I drank in the evenings, I drank on the weekends, but I didn't drink during the day in the morning when I was normally doing. And I could see nothing wrong. And then I found out the next day when I was sitting there, before I ordered the drink, I was shaking, and I thought, what's the matter with me? I was having some nervous disorder, like I was diagnosed as being when I was in grammar school. I was kind of always kind of high-strung and kind of out there. And so I ordered another beer in the San Fernando Valley with my sandwich, and it felt fine after that, and so I started drinking every day for lunch. And then I found out that drinking beer in the middle of the day made me sleepy, so I started having a couple of vodka tonics for lunch. Make them a double, if you will. I'd be doing that. And I'd be working and the whole thing, and then my lunches got earlier and earlier. Sometimes I'd have lunch on the way to work in the morning at 6 o'clock, you know. And I've thought of this kind of recently, how I allowed myself to behave in this alcoholic fashion that I was now behaving in, how I allowed myself with my background and my, I came from a family that didn't even drink. That shows you how sick my life was. And I had to learn how to do this all by myself. Anyway, my wife was complaining about my drinking, and so I kind of watched it around her. I hid bottles in the garage, and up behind the garage in other strategic locations where you could work bottle A into bottle B, and watch the lines go up and down, and I just drank all the time. And one particular evening, I'd come home from work. Typical day, nothing new had happened in my life. I'd lay down the living room floor or the couch or something to have a little rest before dinner. And she claims I was passed out, which is a blatant lie. I was just tired. And I had had a drink when I got home from work. And she couldn't understand how I could be passed out after having one scotch and water. I mean, it's not that hard to do. And but I'd already had a quart during the day. And I was doing this every day. And I went on this way. And it was a problem and all that sort of stuff. The alcohol stopped working for me. What happened to me is that I... couldn't you get a softer seat? This is a hard seat.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. We'll get another one.
I'm used to having better bar stools to sit on. I sought the help of a psychiatrist because of my mood changes. I was getting very depressed. I mean, I might be at some club on Sunset Strip and drink, as I did one particular night. I drank 27 scotch and water. Why I count them, I don't know. And then I drove a whole bunch of people home. And, you know, and happy and gay and had a wonderful time. And then a few hours later or the next day, I'm sitting in my car beating my fist on the steering wheel, wondering what's wrong with me, where my life all go to hell. Why life is so sad and horrible and screwed up. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And I sought the help of a psychiatrist, and of course, he would help me as much as he could. In fact, he asked me one time, how much do you drink? Of course, I lied to him like you're supposed to. I told him 6 or 8 ounces of alcohol a day, doctor. It seemed like a normal amount for a heavy drinker. I'm more than happy to be a heavy drinker, because it is, after all, a sign of manhood or adulthood for me to control and enjoy my drinking was my great obsession. I don't quite understand. When I was controlled, I wasn't enjoying it. When I was enjoying it, I wasn't controlled, but I couldn't see any of that in those days. And all I wanted to have is to people get off my goddamn back and leave me alone. I go to work every day religiously, 6 days a week. I take the kids to the goddamn Indian guides and the movie they want to see. And I was a good father. And it was just, I really was put upon. Anyway, I continued to see this doctor. And one day I was in the little club in Beverly Hills, rather around the corner of my psychiatrist's office. I had a drink since noon now. And I used to go in these people's lovely home, big, I had a very high class clientele. And I used to love to go in. They'd give me the keys to their house or show them where the key was hidden or whatever. I'd go in the house and they trusted me, like I'm trustworthy. And I always loved going into their master bathrooms and going through the medicine cabinet and taking things that said, do not operate heavy machinery, that sort of stuff, you know, and stealing booze out of their house. And I'm embarrassed to tell anybody about this, but that's what I was doing. But it's not a very nice thing to talk about. Anyway, this doctor, this psychiatrist, one day I walked into his office when I'd been to the little club. I had a few drinks before the session. You always have a few drinks before your psychological session because you can be more honest, more straightforward, and you can, you know, be better that way. And so this particular day, he looked at me and he said, you know, you're drunk. I said, what do you mean I'm drunk? It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I said, what do you mean I'm drunk? He said, you look drunk, you act drunk, and you smell drunk. Well, I had a couple of beers for lunch, which was their stock answer. He says, I think it's a little bit more than that and a little bit more recent. And he's going to help me with my drinking problem, albeit my non-existent drinking problem, but I'll go along with the gag, whatever. And he put me on heavy dose of Lyrium and heavy dose of Stelazine, the same kind of drugs they gave that guy in the book, in the movie called A Beautiful Mind. Well, he was Looney Tunes. I'm just a little neurotic electrician, for Christ's sake, you know. Anyway, and he told me not to drink with these drugs. Well, what do they know? You know, so I'm on the job, popping these pills and drinking behind them and doing all this kind of wiring, remodels of kitchens and bathrooms and, you know, doing all kinds of sophisticated work. I don't know if there was any major electrical problems that I caused. I don't really know. I don't know of any major fires I caused. But, hell, shit happens. So anyway, I went on that way for quite a while. My wife was losing a sense of humor, which they do. And so she files for divorce, a miserable bitch. Here I am, stuck, you know, looking for a place to live in the area that I live in. I mean, this is not fun. You're looking at a victim here. I am a victim. There's no question of that. Anyway, I got my one room place right behind my favorite drinking bar called the Cork and Fork on Westwood Boulevard. Well, I had sort of a routine. I'd sit in my wet bed from perspiration or what have you in the morning, and I'd go to the linen closet and pour my morning drink and have another one. 8 o'clock in the morning came, I had a half a pint to a pint on my stomach, and I'd go off and go to work, which I did every day religiously. And hope I would last until lunchtime. And some days I would last until lunchtime. But usually around 10 or 10:30, I'd get those shakes again, and those terrors would come back. Excuse me, I'll be right back. I just got to run down to the hardware store for something and lay down the front seat of my car and drink a little hot vodka and get the motor running where I could last until lunchtime, and I could sit at these bars. And, you know, it was just not much fun. My wife came to visit me in October of 65. She said she wanted to see me while I wasn't drinking. I was kind of like home on my vodka break. And she told me what kind of a husband I was, what kind of a father I was, what kind of a son I was to my own mother and dad, and what was I going to do about Christmas was coming up, and the kids needed toys and clothes, and the attorney wants to be paid, and they turned the electricity off again, and they turned the phone off. I don't know what she's telling me about these things. I mean, I've got my own problems. I don't need all these problems. Anyway, she mercifully left. And fortunately for me, the night before, I had just purchased 100 second all sleeping pills, of which I took all of those, a bunch of scotch, and I just checked out. It's the understandable thing to do, because you get to a point with your alcoholism and your drug addiction when you really can't go on any longer. I mean, I don't want to quit drinking, but I don't want to stop either. And but you get to a point where you really can't go any longer. And I knew I couldn't stop drinking, and I didn't want to stop drinking. So the only thing to do is to take all these second-hall sleeping pills, 100 of them, to wash them down with some scotch and lay down a little cot I was sleeping on and went to sleep. And essentially died that Thursday morning in 1965 in October. And the kid that was working for me part-time thought I was acting a little bizarrely. And he came to my apartment, found me in this coma. And they called the ambulance. They could see what was going on. Called the ambulance. And they shipped me out to UCLA Medical Center, where they put me full of holes. And I guess they pumped my stomach. It wasn't there. And I was there for about 13 hours. They didn't expect me to live, but I somehow managed to come to. And my vital signs came around. They shipped me by ambulance to another place, which is a mental institution, where they put people like us in those days. They didn't have the recovery facilities that we have today. They didn't have things like that. It was just where they put us. And I guess it was not that far afield, but that's what it was. And I was in this mental institution for a while. I had a 24-hour guard on me. I guess they were afraid I was going to do something weird. And I would make my little ashtray well enough to let me out. And I had plenty of Thorazine to keep me very tranquil. And I got out, and the first place I stopped was Jerry's Liquor Store in Olympic. And I bought a quart of vodka and a quart of scotch. And of all the things that I talk about in this phase of my talk, wouldn't you think I'd stay sober a couple of months? A couple of weeks, maybe? A couple of days? Couple hours. I know that I can't go in my room naked with nothing to drink because they drank it all up. So I stopped at Jerry's and got a quart of each. And I started drunk that weekend, but I'm drunk every day to make any difference. And I went right back to the same fashion of drinking and living that I was used to. That's all I knew. And I went to Mass on Christmas of 1965. And I got in the back of that church and I asked God to grant me some peace. I want to quit drinking, as I said earlier. But I want to sleep for more than 2 hours at a time. Getting to sleep is not a major problem because you drink all through the day. By 8 or 9 o'clock at night, you're pretty well passed out after a couple of quarts of booze. And this is every day. And 2 days later, I woke up one morning and nothing new had happened in my life. There was no new trauma, whatever. And I went to the linen closet where I hid the booze for myself. And old habits die hard, I guess. And I fixed my morning drink, and another one. 8 o'clock in the morning came, and I had a half a pint in my stomach, and I could go off and go to work. And I went to put the bottle of vodka back on the top shelf, and I noticed a bottle of Ballantine scotch had about that much left. I thought, Christ, that's a lot of scotch since 8 o'clock the night before. It was remarkable how much I was drinking, and it was no more or no less that I was drinking all the way along, but it was kind of like shown to me. And I went to the phone a few hours later, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous of all places. And I went to a meeting that night at Ohio Street in West L.A. And I sat in the back of the room where you sort of sit when you're new. Don't get too close, and don't pick up any coffee cups or think you're a member. And I sat back there on my hands, afraid someone's going to see me shaking because I didn't have quite enough to drink that evening. And I had green slime coming out of my mouth from the breath purifier as I was chewing, so nobody knew I was drinking. I was sweating profusely on this cold January night. And I walked up to a man who was going to be my sponsor. He was the secretary of the group that year. I said, excuse me, sir, you seem to be some sort of a big deal around here. How do you join Alcoholics Anonymous? He says, you don't drink, kid. I said, yes, I'm planning on cutting down. And he said, no, you don't have a grasp of problem. You don't drink here a day at a time. I said, it's very easy for you to see it, but you're sober sometimes, but I can't go a whole day without a drink. I tried it one day in July, and it damn near killed me. He thought that was that's so goddamn funny. And he got some of the guys, he's sponsoring some of his friends and gathered them around me and wanted me to repeat what I had just said, which I didn't want to, but I what else I could do. So they got a laugh out of it. It's kind of true. If you can't exploit and make fun of the new people, what good are they? And so...
So thus,
this man convinced me that I could get out of my room in the morning without drinking, which is something up till now I was unable to do. But that's what I was able to do. And I went down to Santa Monica Beach, like he told me. I walked up and down that beach all that day, drinking Cokes and coffee and ate Hershey bars and drank a bunch of that Carol syrup I heard about in those A&A meetings. I probably should have died of a diabetic coma, but somehow I didn't drink that whole day. And I went to the meeting that night. And when I was sitting at the meeting, it came over me. I was amazed that this was the longest time I'd been sober since I was a junior in high school. I thought, this is amazing. And I didn't drink the next day, nor the next day. And it's hard to believe, but last... January 6th, I got a cake with 48 candles on it, which is a lot of surprise. A long time between drinks, but I was in the car two Wednesday nights with a newcomer, which I don't advise that. But anyway, this newcomer was very much impressed with I had 48 years. I mean, he was just couldn't believe that I was sober that long. He didn't even have 48 days. And I told him, I said, I'm very grateful to have 48 years. And I wouldn't trade any day of it. But I said, there's nothing as important as today. That's all we really have is today. And we're sober today. And I just wish you well and whatever. And I think he's still sober. I don't know whether he is or not. I don't know. But it's remarkable. I got very active on the program. My wife and I reconciled. Had some naive idea. She was going to go to Al-Anon and get the kids to go to Al-Ateen and Al-Tot, get the daughter to go to Al-Pet and other stuff. But it was not going to happen. She couldn't see the need for Al-Anon. Her life was, after all, my life. And so that's the way it was going to be. So anyway, I continued on with the program. I flipped out when I was sober about 8 or 9 months. One of those days, you know, I just went goofy, truly Looney Tunes. And I ended up at my sponsor's house quite late that night, got him out of bed, and I just told him, because we sponsors, that's our job, is that we have magic sentences to give the people that we sponsor. And, you know, they have a bad problem, and you give them a magic sentence, and everything is wonderful. If they have real serious problems, then, of course, you give them two magic sentences. But this particular night, he was fresh out. He had nothing to tell me. He said, it's time for you to go and do a searching and fearless moral inventory, which is a fourth step. And I didn't say how it applied to me. I spent all my life in the Catholic system of examination of conscience and confession. If that's not a fourth or fifth step, what is? Years and years and years I spent in psychiatrist offices talking about what I used to be like, what I am, what I'm like now. And I've been there, done that. I don't need all that kind of stuff. And one of my problems in life is too much introspection. I thought too much about myself and berated myself for this and all this sort of stuff. And I don't need any goddamn inventories, for Christ's sake. But like they say, any business run without an inventory is not in very good shape. So that's why they asked us to take a major one and a fourth step, and why they can tell you to continue to take them on a daily basis if necessary. Just do that whole thing. Just do it. You don't have to question it or want it. Just do the goddamn thing. Just do it. Like Nike says. Maybe Nike was a member of AA. I don't know. These two sons grew up. And when they were, getting out of high school, I looked at both of them. They're both of them stoned out of their minds. Both of them drunks. Addicts. And I thought, this is fun. And here I am, Mr. AA now, sober 8 years. And I've got these kids. And my wife went along with what the kids were doing. Is that they're just kids and they just... That's what they all do and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, she filed for divorce in January of 74. And that's when I moved down to Dana Point, where I live near now. And as I was driving down the freeway, I was thinking, am I doing my will or his will? When you're around here a while, you don't want to screw this thing up. You want to do it correctly. And so I said a prayer that my sponsor gave me, and I share it with you. And I say it every day, several times every day. And the prayer goes like this: God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me. And I cannot know for certain where it'll end. Nor do I really know myself. And the fact I think I'm following your will does not mean that I'm actually doing so. But I believe this. I believe the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in everything I do. And I hope I never do anything apart from that desire. And I know if I do this, you will lead me by the right road. Though I may know nothing about it at the time, I seem to be lost in the very shadow of death. I'll not be afraid because I know you will never leave me to face my troubles all alone. This again, you know, the freeway. And of course, I tell them the kind of apartment I want. I want the business to be run. I was about 3.5 minutes too late for the Yellow Pages, so I spent a whole year with no advertising. And it was a bad year. 1974 was a tough year. I, you know, missed the family situation. I started business in the foreign land, as far as I'm concerned, in South Orange County. And back and forth to Los Angeles, where I could get what little work I could get and build up my business down in Orange County. It was very difficult. Anyway, I got through it. And that's what we all do. We all get through anything, everything and anything, if we do it together and we have people to do it with. If you're new and you're doing this by yourself, you're doing it wrong. It's a we thing. It's something we all do together. Anyway, I started a date again, and that didn't go too well. I wasn't too good at it in high school, but that's when I was in my early 40s. And I met this gal, and it was on again, off again. And finally, I just left and got started over again. And she called me on our natal birthdays, which are August 19th, and hers is the 20th, invited me to go to dinner. And I thought, well, I don't know, a free meal. I'm very romantic, so that's what I did. And we headed off, and things were different, and things were really good, and we started to go back together again. And she ended up in the South Coast Hospital with in South Laguna with breast cancer. And so she had the surgery, the mastectomy, and constant radiation and chemotherapy and all of that stuff. If you've been with anybody that suffered and died with cancer, you know what I'm talking about. If you don't know, you really don't want to know. Anyway, and she had about 7 surgeries, and it was just it was difficult. But her 3 daughters and a son loved to come to visit us, and my 2 sons loved to come to visit us too. In their various stages of stoneness, all 6 of them just were all stoned all the time. Anyway, they're very perverse people. Anyway, we got through all of that, and my youngest son fell out of a 2nd-story window, stoned on angel dust and some cheap wine, and broke himself all up and ended up in East L.A. General Hospital. And I went to visit him. He said, Jim, this isn't much to shoot for. He said, no, Dad, I'm having too good a time. So he stayed up there. And he did come down, because I invited him to come down to Dana Point and get himself an apartment, come to work for me, which he ultimately did, because he knew that I wouldn't tolerate anybody that was loaded when he was working. I mean, I just can't have that. So he stayed sober in front of me. But he got picked up one Saturday night for drunk walking, And when he got out of the Santa Ana jail, he realized he had to quit drinking. So he did with nothing at all. He just quit drinking. And I was having lunch with Clint Hodges, a friend of ours who's passed on now, and Jim and I. And he said, you ought to come to the Wednesday night speaker meeting, the one that Glory was talking about. And he came to that meeting, and he loved it. And he stood up as a newcomer, and he stayed sober for 26 years. And he was working for me, and everything was fine. Then all of a sudden, one day, he calls me on the phone. He says, I got to talk to you, Dad. I got to talk to you now. And I said, well, sure, we'll see each other. And I said, no, I got to talk to you now. I said, okay. I met him at some coffee shop on Forest Avenue in Laguna, and he informs me that he's gay. I thought, huh? How could that be? Something I did or didn't do? It's something. It's always about me. And I had to work through all of that and adjust through that whole thing. And I was not pleased with it or whatever. Well, we worked through all of that whole thing. In fact, he and Patrick, his significant other, they've been together for 30 years, which is pretty good for that type of relationship. Anyway, they moved to Hawaii. They moved to Maui in Lahaina. And they set up a business over there. Among other things, they fit and sold toe rings, which is every father's dream to have that particular deal. I was whining at him about 20 years ago. I said, Jim, it doesn't look like I'm ever going to become a grandfather. He says, well, we're trying. So anyway, I'll explain that later on the way home. But... So anyway, when Jim came down with, they lived over there a few years, and when he came down and diagnosed with HIV, which was pretty devastating to see him go through that whole routine. And he got on, moved to San Francisco, where he lives now, and he got hooked up on the painkillers that they have with the HIV stuff to sleep and all that. And he got addicted to one of them, and then he went back to drinking after 26 years in the program, got picked up for common drunk in San Francisco. Well, he's back now, and he's got sober, I guess, around 6 years. I should ask him how many years he has now. Very active up there in the community AA, doing very, very well. And that's their deal. My oldest son, he's sober 20... he'll be sober 31 years in December. Is that right? Is that correct? He's got a year less than Gloria. And he made a grandfather out of me, two grandsons. He got married on the AA campus. That lasted enough time to get two grandsons, and then she decided she didn't want to be married to him anymore, so they split up, and that broke my heart. At about the same time, Jim went back out to drinking. It was just not a fun year. But you do what you do, and you get through all the whole thing. All you can do is love your kids and hope they work out as well as they can. But, you know, sometimes they don't work out in the way you want them to work out in your time schedule. So a lot of acceptance goes there, too. And anyway, when my second wife passed away the day after Christmas of 1985, I was devastated. I thought, how can this be? You know, I had turned her cancer over in a third step, and she died anyway. There's something wrong with this picture. And I was devastated. I thought, how can this possibly be? And I don't know what I was going to... I was very upset about the whole thing. And I spent 1986 was a terrible year. There was no joy. There was just... I went to work every day. I did all this AA shit and all the other stuff that we do. And I went through it all. And just suited up and showed up and went through the motions, and I got through it all. And it turned out that the end of 86, I had a pretty good year because of the third step. In the third step, my God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. Thy power, thy love, thy way of life. May I do thy will always. And I see myself that way now. I see a guy that's been around. I've got a lot of experience, drunk and sober. And I know how to stay sober. Don't know very much, but I do know how to stay sober. And my life has changed. I had to retire in the last of the brain surgery. And it's been difficult to accept all that sort of stuff. And I can't walk very far. And I have two fucked up knees. That's an orthopedic term. And you're laughing at my poor knees. And both my lungs are fucked up. That's a pulmonary disorder. And it's just, you know, you wonder, what's it all mean? But yet my life is wonderful. I married this beautiful lady who you heard before I talked. And even though I had to take her son, but I mean, that's another thorn in my side. But anyway, it's been a wonderful life to be sober all these years and to have the amount of people that I've worked with, amount of people that I sponsor. Without them, I don't know what I would do to get out of myself. The interesting thing is, I was thinking recently that, you know, I think basically of myself. Me, myself, and I, my wife, my children, my health, my finance, everything's me, 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 me. When we get out of ourselves, do we have any kind of relief? And that's what we do in this program. How can I help you? And I see myself now. What can I do to help you? And one thing I can do is not talk 5 minutes past. I'm very sorry. I've over-talked. And I apologize. But anyway, you can buy the tape. Thank you very much.
Another round of applause. Here with us in the bar. Okay, so we still have a little bit more to go. We like to honor.